Okay, so today's shiur is going to be unusual in the way that usually I choose what we learn. And this week, Shlomo Wahlberg chose what we're learning. He actually gave me a piece from Rav Zevin, which is a beautiful, beautiful piece. I'm sure everyone heard of Rav Zevin. If you didn't, he's most known for the Encyclopedia Talmudis, the Talmudic Encyclopedia, which is a monumental project that he was in charge of the first few volumes. He's also known for writing quite a few interesting svarim, and one of them is actually Sipuri Chasidim. It's probably one of the first real great works of Hasidic stories, Sipuri Chasidim. It's translated by Art Scroll, a treasury of Hasidic tales on the Torah and the holidays, which is a beautiful, beautiful books to have, stories on every parsha, etc. But he also has a sefer called, which one is this one? Torah LeMayadim. And Rav Zevin was a Chabad Chassid. He wasn't a Lubavitcher Chassid. He was a Kapust Chabad. You know, before the three Rebbes ago, so when the Tzemach Tzedek passed away, there were a lot of different streams of Chabad. Chabad is a type of way of serving Hashem, and he was a Kapust Chabad. And this piece that he gives on Purim, the first piece on Purim, essentially what he's doing is he's putting together three different mamorim from the Alter Rebbe. If you learn the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya Sefer on Purim is called Torah Or. It's the one in Bereishis Shmos on Megillas Esther. And over there, he has quite a few mamorim. It's about over 10 pages worth of mamorim, different Hasidic discourses. And Rav Zevin sort of puts some of these ideas together in one coherent way, in a very beautiful way. So we're going to go through tonight these ideas, because it's actually probably, I've never seen any place else where it's so clearly says the idea of what Purim is all about, that he takes out like the main ideas from those mamorim of what Purim is all about. Mamash, to give a proper presentation and an entrance into the deeper meaning of the day of Purim. So I'm not going to necessarily do it in the order that Rav Zevin presents it, but if you want to see later on, it's in the Sefer Torah Mayadim, Ois Aleph, that's where I'm getting it from. So let's start like this. The way that I always like to start this inyan that Rav Zevin is speaking about is, and again, what I'm saying now, it's from three mamorim of the Alter Rebbe. One is called Vayishan HaMelech LeEsther, one is Chai Vinish LeBesume, another one is Vekibla Yehudim Esashay Chelu Lasses. It's three different mamorim. But so everything I'm going to say is from those three mamorim. So the Alter Rebbe brings a pasuk in Amos. It's one of the most scary psukim in the entire Bible. And the pasuk is, well, you know, before I tell you the pasuk, I'm going to, let's do a little quiz over here. Does anyone know, can anyone tell me, what letter is missing from Ashrei? We say Ashrei at least three times a day, and it goes according to the letters of the Aleph Beis. There's one letter missing. Which letter?
Nun.
Nun. Anyone know why? Go.
Because I forgot the exact word, but nun is, the word that goes with nun is like not or nisht.
Not or nisht, or neither of them are Hebrew.
Yeah, but
you're close.
Yeah.
Anyone remember? It's the Gemara in Brachas, in the beginning of the Gemara in Brachas. Oh, Neufel, right. What the Gemara in Brachas says, that David HaMelech saw a certain pasuk from Amos. The famous Amos, not the one with the chocolate chips. David HaMelech saw a pasuk from Amos that was so scary and so intimidating, it scared him so much that because of this pasuk, he didn't want to write a pasuk with Ashrei with a Nun. The pasuk is, and this is essentially what tonight's entire shir, what the Alter Rebbe explains the entire Purim is about, is the pasuk says as follows. Nafla loy soisif kum besulas Yisrael. She has fallen, and she shall not rise up again, the maiden of Israel. Nafla loy soisif kum. She has fallen, and she shall not rise up again, besulas Yisrael, the maiden of Israel. Now, that's obviously a very scary pasuk, that she is fallen, will not rise up again. So the Mefarshim go to town, and they do that mefarshim, that thing that mefarshim do, oh so well. And they go, they have all sorts of ways of trying to read it differently, and they put the comma differently. The mefarshim read it, nafla loy soisif, comma, kum besulas Yisrael. She has fallen, and she shall no longer, comma, rise up, the maiden of Israel. Right? So that's you just move the comma. The only problem is that's not what the pasuk is saying. That's just a slight problem. So you could have different ways of explaining the pasuk, and that's what the Mefarshim do, the commentators. But the pasuk says she has fallen and she shall not rise up again, the maiden of Israel. Now, of course, you all know that when it comes to prophecies, we have a rule that prophecies that are positive cannot be abrogated. It's one of the things Maimonides says, how we know who's a true prophet and who's a false prophet. A prophet that says a good prophecy and it doesn't come to pass, you know it's a false prophet. A prophet that says a bad negative prophecy and it doesn't come to pass, it doesn't yet tell you they're not a real prophet. Why? Because even though the prophet said a bad prophecy,
we could do tshuva.
So that could be abrogated. So an easy thing to say is that this is a nevuat zam, as they say in Israel, a dire black prophecy that hopefully will do tshuva and it won't come to pass. But and David HaMelech was so scared of this pasuk that that's why we don't say Nun and Ashrei, just because we're afraid of this pasuk.
Where's the pasuk come from again?
Amos. But comes the Alter Rebbe and says that the pasuk is kipshutai, that Nafla loy soisif kum besulas Yisrael, she has fallen and she shall not rise up again, the maiden of Israel, and it's literal, and that's what we're all waiting for. The messianic redemption that the Jewish people have waited for 2,000 years is the time when we will no longer rise up again. And the Alter Rebbe says that the secret to understand this is the holiday of Purim. Purim is the secret of the fact that we will not rise up again. Which is why Purim is the secret of Mashiach. We all know the Rambam brings. It's a Rambam. Chazal said and the Rambam brings it. That kol ha-moedim b'teilim la'asalavei chutz mipurim. All the other yontes will be batal, which usually translated as nullified when Mashiach comes, except for Purim. Shanema, like the Megillah says, Yimei Purim Eila La Yosef Zichram Mitech Zarim, that the memory of Purim will not ever go away from their seed. Purim will always be there. All the other yontifs will be nullified. Now, of course, it doesn't mean Chas V'Shalom that we're not going to keep Sukkot and Pesach when Mashiach comes. We believe that the entire Torah is eternal. So what does it mean all the other yontifs are B'Telem, that they're nullified? It's sort of going to be like Tu B'Shvat today. Like Tu B'Shvat is a yontif, but like, you know, it's not like, you don't make a big deal out of it, right? So batal means it's not going to be Pesach and Sukkot when Mashiach comes, are going to be like minor festivities. Purim is going to be that's not going to be batal. That's going to be a prime yontif. That's going to be the yontif when Mashiach comes. Purim. Says the Alter Rebbe, you know why? Because Mashiach is the secret of Purim, which is the secret of she has fallen and she shall not rise up again, the maiden of Israel. So in order to understand this, we need to understand what's Mashiach, what's Purim, what is that about? What does it mean we will not rise up again? So the first thing that the Alter Rebbe says to explain is that what do we see, what do we know right away if we want to compare Purim to all the other Yomim Tovim that has Mashiach in common with it? What does Purim and Mashiach have in common? So one thing we know, if we're going to compare Purim to all the other Yomim Tovim, what do we know about the miracle of Purim that's different than all the other Yomim Tovim? Nothing supernatural happened. There's no name of God in the Megillah. It was a 12-year, people don't notice this, but from the beginning of the Megillah till the end was 12 years. Hopefully you get a Balkari. I give you all a bracha, you should have a Balkari that does it within half hour. Mm-hmm. Right? I've been to places where it's been brutal, but the Megillah from beginning to end takes place 12 years. So this whole long saga, if you get it read to you in half hour, you see that it's one big miracle. But it was nothing supernatural happened. It's this romantic story of a nutty king and his temper and all these things that took place. And there was nothing supernatural. Other holidays all were some kind of supernatural phenomena. Whether it was Pesach, whether it was Sukkot, Shavuos, Hanukkah, everything else that we know, there was something supernatural happened. And what do we know about Mashiach? What does the Rambam paskin in the Laws of Kings, chapter 11? The Rambam says something very fascinating. Says the Rambam, Al yal al adas, don't even think Shemashiach osid lasas oisus amoisim ela oilam kimin hagay noyeg. Do not think that when Mashiach comes, there are going to be miracles, the Rambam says. Don't even think it. Rather, oylam kimen hagei noyeg. The world will continue in its natural order. That's what the Rambam says. Now, by the way, parenthetically, it's a little problematic of it. What do you mean, Mashiach comes, there are not going to be any miracles? First of all, you know it's a matter of debate in the Gemara. It's a machlekes Rav and Shmuel in the Gemara and Sanhedrin and Chelek, right? But according to the opinion that there'll be no miracles, which the Rambam paskins like la halacha, anyone have a question saying that Mashiach will be no miracles when Mashiach comes? Yeah.
Yeah, but if
stick with what I'm asking. Do you have a question on this? Yeah.
If when Mashiach comes, the ikar is that we'll be able to see Hashem.
Just stick with what I'm saying. I need to keep a mahalach. Does anyone have any questions about the fact that
the Rambam says there won't be a miracle if it's dafka not outside the realm of possibility?
what would be a problem that you would ask in the Rambam halachically? The Rambam says there won't be any miracles when Mashiach comes. Miracles, what could you ask on that? The Beis HaMikdash being built. Well, that you could say that he holds according to those that say that will build the Beis HaMikdash.
I'm saying the miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash.
Miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash, okay. Anyone other, any other questions, very simple questions you might ask?
Will carry on wings? I mean, Mashiach itself.
Carry on wings. We see many psukim. In Micha, Ki meitzeis chemeretz mitzrayim arenu nifloi, says, in the days that I took out of Egypt, I will show you miracles. Or who remembers, what's the 13th principle of faith? Resurrection. It's pretty miraculous. I mean, it happened to, you know, Brad Pitt, but that was only temporarily, right? Until he won World War Z. But then there's going to be a resurrection. That's pretty miraculous. So there are many that argue in the Rambam. And the main answer you have to say, according to the Rambam, is that there are going to be two eras. Two tkufis, two epics, two times. There's going to be the first time of Mashiach where there won't be any miracle, which is going to be part of a messianic redemption. And then later on, there'll be, you have to say, according to the Rambam, there will be miracles. But one thing for sure, the Rambam says that part of the redemptive process is that there has to be a time that there won't be any miracles. Now, again, it's a matter of debate in the Gemara. And the Rambam not only takes that side, but if you heard the words that I quoted, the Rambam uses the words Al Yal Al Adas. Sha'ad Mashiach Asid Las. Al Yal Al Adas. Don't even think that Mashiach's going to make miracles. Now, the Rambam wasn't Hungarian. And he didn't seemingly use flowery, extreme language for no reason. And the Rambam is saying, Al Yal Al Adas. Don't even think Mashiach is going to be. Why is it like so ogifreged? It's so negated. Don't. It's like the weirdest thing you would ever imagine. That Mashiach is going to do miracles. Meaning that the Rambam is adamant that Mashiach comes, there won't be miracles. And so whatever the reason is, which we're going to learn why the Rambam is so adamant about it, we understand right away the connection to Purim. We understand the connection to Purim, which is the only holiday we have where there was no miracle. There was no miracle out of the order of this of the natural world. There was nothing supernatural.
Is it that is the Rambam's kavana that the Mashiach himself won't do the nisim and the miracles, but rather it would happen at that time? Because not necessarily just the bias of Mashiach in itself will bring tchias mesim, tchias medash, but he himself may not be the one who
announced
it.
So there's a lot of mahalchim to explain this Rambam. That's not the point of tonight's shiur, because there's a lot of explanations to get into that. You could go spend days just discussing the sheet of the Rambam. But the bottom line is, what's relevant to us is that however you explain it, the Rambam is adamant. Al Yal Al Adas. If you're familiar with the Rambam's language, he's screaming the Rambam. Al Yal Al Adas. Don't think Mashiach is going to do miracles. The Rambam is adamant that you have to say that there's not going to be miracles at a certain point of the Messianic redemption, which we understand is that's why Purim is the holiday. So let's understand. This is what we need to explain.
And you're saying that even
I'm not saying anything.
Well,
the Alter Rebbe is saying.
The Rambam's position disagrees with this opinion in the Gemara.
Which opinion?
Well, you said that there's a Rav and Shmuel have this machlokes whether there will be miracles
or not. So he's poskening like one.
Right, but saying don't even like he's not even acknowledging that it's a.
So what you're saying is a good point. The truth is that if you know the rules of Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition, is the Rambam allowed to argue with the Gemara?
No.
What is the Rambam allowed to do? Make a psak as a poisik. He can make a halachic ruling, but usually there's a rule. He could only make a halachic ruling if it's relevant lamaisa, right? If it's relevant practically. That's how he's allowed to make a halachic ruling. So what embedded in your question, I think, which is true, is that seemingly, we would say in learning, lamai nafkamina, why does the Rambam need to make a halachic ruling in this matter? About whether there's going to be miracles when Mashiach comes. In other words, it's a machlekes in the Gemara, and we'll see. For some reason, not only is the Rambam saying that I have to make a halachic ruling that there won't be miracles, but he's screaming Al Yal Al Adas. He's saying you must say that there won't be miracles at least at some point. You must say that. Otherwise, it's like the redemption hasn't happened. So that's what we need to explain. So like this. In order to understand, therefore, the holy need of Purim and Mashiach, we need to look very carefully at the two main differences there are between Purim and every other Yom Tov. And this is the way the Alter Rebbe says there's two main halachic differences between Purim and all the other Yom Tovim. And we'll see that they're interconnected. All the other Yomim Tovim are called the Yontiv. What's Yontiv by Jews? Mikra Kodesh. What does that tell you, that something's a Yontiv? It's Asa B'Malacha. You can't do any labor. Asa B'Malacha. Even Chanukah, which we're not going to get into tonight, but you know that there's a minug, that when the candles are lit, there's also a little Isser Malacha, right? Purim is the only Yontiv that there's no Isser Malacha at all. Yontiv, Mikra Kodesh, is Asa B'Malacha. You can't do any labor. You can't... I always say put on lights and stuff, right? You can't do malacha. You're not allowed to profane the holy day. Purim, there's no Isser Malacha at all. Not only, by the way, is no Isser Malacha, but everyone remembers in the Gemara Megillah that you remember Mordechai wanted there to be. He tried to make that it should be Isser Malacha and Le Kiblu Alayu. The Jewish people said, no Isser Malacha on Purim. And we understand that's not just because we weren't in the mood for to whip out the crock pot again, but that obviously it's a deep thing. Right? So Purim, there's no Isser Malacha. All the other Yom Tovim, there is an Isser Malacha. And the other difference is, on all the other Yom Tovim, you're Yotze with a Revius Yayin. Wine, you have to drink a Revius. And I don't just mean for Kiddush. There's a din of Simchas Yontiv. Right? We know there's a din of Simchas Yontiv. You're supposed to drink a Revius Yayin. Which, by the way, quick halachic parenthetical thing that you should all know. Which day of Yontiv are you? But which day of the 7 days of the festival of Pesach or the 8 days of the festival of Sukkot are you supposed to have a revius of wine?
All of them. Every day.
All of them. Woo-hoo. Very important. Chol HaMoed, make sure to drink it. It's not a lot, but a revius, because there's a din of Simchas Yontiv, Samachta B'Chagecha, every day, including Chol HaMoed. So you're supposed to have a revius of wine every day, according to the Alter Rebbe and many Pesachim. It's a mitzvah deraisa of a Samachta B'Chagecha to have a revius yain. So unless you have alcoholism problems. Do it. Make sure that every day you have at least a revius, at least a little amount of wine. Anyway, so by Simchas Yontiv there's a din, revius yayim. By Purim, how much wine do you need?
As much as you can handle.
As much as you can handle and then some. Adela yoda, without hagbolus, without any measurements at all, the opposite, to go out of all your measurements, out of your finitude. So you see over the Alter Rebbe says that we see these two things somehow. Yontiv is asur b'malacha, and there's a shear, how much wine you need. There's a shear to the simcha. There's a limitation to the simcha. Purim is mutter b'malacha. There's no prohibition of malacha. And adula yada. And these two things, the Alter Rebbe say, one connects to the other. Yontiv, which is mikra kodesh, is asur b'malacha, only a little wine, only a shear. Simchas Yontiv is a finite joy. Purim, which doesn't have a name of Hashem, is not Kodesh, it's not Asa Malach, it's not a holy day. Hashem's name is not in the Megillah, it's not a supernatural miracle. There's no Asa Malacha and Adela Yada. So what the Alter Rebbe says as follows, I'm going to say the sentence the Alter Rebbe says, get the sentence clearly, I'll probably say it twice, maybe even three times, and then we'll spend about half hour explaining it. But here's the sentence the way the Alter Rebbe says it, okay? The Alter Rebbe differentiates between two times in the Megillah, Ahasuerus extends his scepter to Esther. Who remembers the two times? $67,000 question. Who remembers the two times the king extended his scepter to Esther? Yeah, David?
When Esther comes to approach him after 3 days of Tanis,
mm-hmm.
that she comes to ask him Mama Kashaseh.
Right.
And then at the end, when he hands over Haman's ring, which was the king's ring initially, and he extends his scepter.
Beautiful. The first time was when Esther goes in when without permission. She goes into the king without permission. After 3 days of fasting, she put her life on the line. The king extended his scepter, Vatoshara Melech Esther Shavar Azov. And then at the end of the Megillah, when the poor miracle happens and the king gives her base Haman, the house of Haman and everything, and we won, as Jackie Mason says, we won, you know, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. So again, the king extended a scepter to Esther. Now here comes the really difficult question. Does anyone know the difference in wording, in verbiage, the two times the king extended the scepter, the difference in how the Megillah says both times? That's a toughie. And the answer is that at the first time when the king extends the scepter, it says that he extended the scepter to Esther, Vatiga Beresh Hasharvit. She touched the edge of the scepter. And at the end of the Megillah, it says, Vayosha Tamelech LeEsther at Sharvit Azov, he gave her the whole scepter. If you're Madaik in the Megillah, you see that at the beginning, in Esther's approach to the king, which of course always is God, and the whole Megillah, the king is Hashem. So in the beginning, when Esther's trying to approach the king, he extends the scepter, the sharvit, and she touches the edge of the sharvit, and only touches the edge, says the Alter Rebbe. That's Shabbos and Yontif. Shabbos and Yontif is the king extending the sharvit, extending the scepter, and Esther touching the Reish HaSharvit. That's Shabbos and Yontif. But at the end of the Megillah, Purim, says the Alter Rebbe, Vayosha, the king gives her the entire scepter, gives her the entire sharvit. Vayosha Amech Esther Sharvit Azov, he gives her the entire scepter. And the Alter Rebbe says like this, Shabbos and Yontif, touching the edge of the scepter, is now all the rest of our lives, all the times we try to approach God, we only touch the kav, the ray of light, we touch the scepter. Purim, when he gives the entire scepter, God is giving the essence of what he is. And that's the answer to everything that we asked until now. Shabbos and Yontif is touching the edge of the scepter, touching the kav. I'm going to explain what that means in Kabbalah. And Purim is when God is giving the entire scepter, God is giving him his whole self. And therefore there's no prohibition of labor, and therefore you have to drink until you go out of your mind. What does that mean? Let's put all these pieces together. So we need to, that's the sentence. Everyone get the sentence? Shabbos and Yontif in the rest of in exile, we're always trying to touch the edge of the sharvit. Vatiga Beresha Sharvit, touching the edge of the scepter, touching the kav, touching finite rays of God's light, the kav, the line. Purim and Mashiach is when God will give the entire scepter, he'll give his whole essence, and therefore therefore there's no Isser Malacha on Purim, and therefore you have to drink Adulayoda. What does all this mean? We have to put the pieces together. So that's the global picture. Now we need to go slowly. Okay? We're going to go slowly. So let's begin as follows. We have to build this up to be able to understand this. These are very deep ideas. We have to build them up slowly, step by step. So each step, I want everyone to tell me, no questions that are not relevant, but questions that are not clear what I'm going to say now. We're going to now go four steps. We need to go four steps slowly to understand what this is all saying. Okay? First of all, let's introduce the concept that's found in Kabbalah, the concept of Olamos, worlds. Olamos Elyonim, Olamos Tachtonim, that there are upper worlds and lower worlds. There are many worlds, many Olamos, and there are upper worlds and lower worlds. Does anyone want to give a crack at explaining what that means, that there are different worlds, and what that means that they're upper and lower? No. Okay, yeah, Josh?
I mean,
I love that smile. It means he's about to quote like John Donne or something. Yeah?
I do, but I want to hear what
he gets. Okay, good. So let's first discuss what it means worlds. When we speak about upper and lower worlds, everyone understands right away that it doesn't mean geographically. Is that clear? We all know it doesn't mean geographically. When we speak about upper and lower worlds, it obviously doesn't mean geographically because space is only in physicality. The whole concept of space only exists in the physical world, or if you're a Kantian, in your own mind. So space is not what it means upper and lower worlds. It means, as the Rambam already explains in Mor HaNevuchim, and the guy of the Perplexed Maimonides explains, that when we speak in Ruchnius of space, higher and lower, what do we mean? In stature. Higher and lower means a stature. So upper and lower worlds means level of world. Now, what do we mean level of world? First of all, what does it mean worlds? That there are different worlds. When Kabbalah speaks about worlds, by the way, if anyone ever read, there's a great book from Rav Steinzel, it's called The 13-Petaled Rose, where he explains this really well at length. He connects it to Shabbos, it's worthwhile to look at. Anyway, what does it mean when Kabbalah speaks of different worlds? And this isn't, by the way, what we're learning now is not just a Kabbalistic concept, if you want to be a Kabbalist. We're not Kabbalists in training over here. Why is it relevant to know what Kabbalah speaks about different worlds? You know why that's relevant? Because it's relevant to understand what world we live in. You know that none of us live in the same world, right? None of us live in the same world. Everybody's in their own world. The most you could hope for is to have one or two, maybe three people that are close enough to you to bring them into your world. But everyone's living in a different world, because your perspective is your reality. Your world is your perspective. I'll give you a very similar example, which I've said before, and it's the best example. One of my favorite things, when you're in Manhattan, and you know when people are waiting by a light, and the light turns, and all of a sudden there's like a stampede of 50,000 people crossing a street at once. If you ever stop, and if you're able, if you have the time to do this, to actually just watch, like 200 people crossing a street, and realizing, think for a moment how different each person's world is. Like, they're all crossing the same street, but if you like think for a moment of what's going on in their minds, that crossing the street for one person might be to pick up, you know, a lottery check of $10 million. Or to like go propose to their fiance, and another one's headed to Sloan Kettering. Everyone's living in different worlds, which is where existential loneliness comes from. That's what Rav Soloveitchik speaks about in Lonely Man of Faith, that there could be nothing lonelier than a person's in Times Square in New Year's, Times Square full of people, but having no real companion. Because when you know that you might be surrounded by thousands of people, but you're in your own world and nobody's in your world, there's nothing lonelier than that. So the world you live in has nothing to do with the geographic place that you are. Or like the you could say, you ever hear somebody say, this person's in the fashion world, this person's in the business world, this person's in the chves, meat world, meat packing world. You know, you have a person walks down the street, one person's into real estate, another person's into fashion. Imagine you have two people walking by the same building, and one person says, wow, look how they're displaying those dresses in the window. And the other one's like, wow, isn't this a good location for this building to be? Because one is in the real estate world, one is in the fashion world. So you're living in different world. And by the way, it's relevant to us as Jews, because the world we live in is either with God or without God. Is God in your world? Now, I'm sure I don't need to tell you that being a frum Jew, which I put in big, big, fat, red neon quotation marks, an Orthodox Jew does not yet at all tell us what world we're living in. You could have many people that are not frum, and God is very much part of their world. And there's some people that are Orthodox, and God hasn't penetrated their world. Because the world you live in is your perspective. So we speak about worlds in Kabbalah, we're not talking about a theoretical process and how God created the world. We're talking about life. So what Kabbalah speaks about upper and lower worlds, in very simple English, means how much is your life and your perspective God? And that's what the Rambam, by the way, explains, that the ladder that Jacob saw, angels going up and down, that's what Maimonides, that's what he explained that that means. That's why prayer is that ladder. We're supposed to ascend the ladder during prayer. What does that mean to ascend the ladder? What does it mean to go up in prayer? That your world should be God. How much is my world, my perspective, God? Now, we understand that that's obviously something extremely subjective. But if we say, probably you could say that probably, as I said before, no two people live in exactly the same world. Right? Depends how much God is your world. There are some people where the purpose of my world is God. There are some people that like, I have my world, but I do believe that there's a world to come. And I want to get good real estate there, so I'll do whatever God says. Like, I'll try to, like, make God happy as much as possible without letting him ruin my world. Right? There are plenty of frum Jews like that. I have my world, but I believe in God, and I'm afraid of God. I'm afraid what's going to happen after I die. So as I'm going to make as little as possible, as only shter, and he shouldn't bother my world, but I'll do it as much as I can to maintain my world, and I'll just do what I need to do to, like, to be yitzazai, right? And there are some people that their whole world is about God. And again, this has nothing to do with what you write in your application when you want to send your kids to get into a good school. It's a subjective thing. So it's extremely subjective. Yet, what Kabbalah explains, and this is the best place if you want to see this further, is in Tanya chapter 36. The Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya chapter 36 that generally there are levels of worlds. I know it's an individual thing, but generally there are levels of worlds. General levels of worlds. And therefore, for instance, angels also have different levels, live in different worlds, depending on that level. Now, what would it make that there'd be a level of a world that would make it that my world would be more God? What do you think it would entail if I'm saying there, even though it's usually subjective, but generally, there is general levels of worlds, and upper worlds is where everyone in that world, in the world of Bria, or in the world of Yetzirah, everyone there has more, God is more of the world than in the lower worlds. What do you think would it make it that God is more part of your world in upper worlds as opposed to lower worlds? What do you think that would entail? How would it be, how would God become more your world, your being? What do you think?
More revealed.
More revealed. Why is it that we could live in this world in such a way that could be God is not at all part of my world? Because he's hidden, because he's not revealed. In a higher world, let's say angels, people always say angels don't have bechira. They don't have free choice. It's not that angels don't have free choice. That's a silly way of looking at it. It's not that angels don't have free choice. Angels live in higher worlds where the light of God is revealed, and so they can't go against that. In other words, let me explain. Let's get something clear. Really, what is all of reality is the light of God. Only Hashem exists. And as he says there in Tanya chapter 36, Einoid Milvadei, there's no place devoid of God. Everything, not only, you know, we've already learned many times, it's incorrect phraseology to say God is everywhere. That Uncle Moshe says, which is great for kids. Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, up, up, down, down, right, left, all around here, there Hashem is to be found. That's good in Uncle Moshe, but you know that that's a very childish way of looking at it. When you go a little deeper, you understand you don't say Hashem is everywhere, that's a misnomer.
Everywhere is Hashem.
Everywhere is Hashem. Here, there, everywhere is the light of Hashem. All that exists is Hashem. Everything is the light, is the revelation of God. What differentiates between one world and another is how much do you feel that your whole being is God? I'll give an example. Nishdo gedach neshevkenem gedach, the person that's hooked up to a life support system. Does anyone have, would that person have free choice to pull the plug? I mean, I'm not talking about Dr. Kevorkian. I'm the person that wants to live, yeah? Person that temporarily is on life support because they need, you know, for a couple of days. Is it pshat that he has, you have free choice? I don't have free choice to pull the plug. It's not that you don't have free choice. You wouldn't. You see that your life is based on it, right? And that's only your breath. Angels feel that their whole being, their whole vitality is the light of Hashem. Why do we have free choice? Why do I feel like I'm Shmuel Brun and you're somebody else in this table, something else, and we don't see, why do we not see the oneness of reality? Why do we not see that everything is just Hashem's light? Why don't we see that?
He doesn't want us to.
He doesn't want us to. And what mechanism did he do to make that we shouldn't see it?
He hid himself.
Kabbalah explains in vessels, garments, shells. The concept of tzimtzum. That God concealed his light in vessels, garments, and shells. And depending the different worlds, is God's light in vessels? Is God's light in garments? Or is God's light in shells? Shells, klipas, anyone know in Kabbalah what klipas, what shells is a code word for? Evil. Bad. That's where his light is in a shell, completely encrusted. But the other places, God's light is in vessels and in shells. I'm sorry, vessels and in garments. So this table is the light of God. This chair is the light of God. It's all part of God's oneness. Hashem Echad, only Hashem exists. So why do I see this as a chair and this as a table? Because in this, God's light has entered a vessel and a garment called table. And in this, his light is now manifesting in a vessel and a garment called chair. And as the worlds go further up, what happens as you go further up in worlds? What happens that you feel more, you come in a higher world? What do you need to do? take off the vessels and garments. This chair exists in all worlds, because all worlds are here. Atzilus, the highest world that there is, this chair is there also. But in Atzilus and Bria, how do the angels see this chair? As another way God's manifesting. So what does it mean, upper and lower worlds? How much is the light of God in vessels and garments, or not in vessels and garments? That clear? Yeah.
Okay. So then how is it that a piece of food,
yeah,
will be a vessel,
yeah,
until you eat it, and it goes through you, and then it comes out, and what comes out is a shell?
I don't understand what you're asking.
It's a very technical question.
I mean, how is it that some things can be in one case, like Kedusha, like, you know, they can be used for Kedusha, and be Kedusha, but why is it that you're in a bathroom and you can't dump?
Because some things have in them shells. The reason that a pig can't be used for Kedusha is because the light of God manifesting in a pig is in a shell, and you can't break that shell. You can't reveal that as being Hashem's light until Mashiach comes. You can't break that shell. That's the whole vart of why. That's the pnimius of every machlekes in a Mishnah. Chayiv, Potter, Usser. What's the shaila? What's the shaila if you're it's kosher or not? The shaila is there a shell and I can't reveal this as being Hashem's light, or just a vessel and a garment?
And also, Rabbi.
What's that?
Also, it's Beirurim.
Yeah, that's the Inyan of Birurim. That's the Inyan of Beirur. Right. The Inyan of Beirur is to reveal that.
A bottle of water, it's like saying, how come I can drink the water? I can't drink the bottle. Right? The water you're able to ingest and elevate. The bottle you're not. Right? So
but again, a bottle, you can ingest, but like it's something that I could see it as being a way to help me serve Hashem. So it could also be you're revealing Hashem's light. So this is a huge sugya.
Yeah.
Let's not get into details because we'll never finish. Let's just. It's very important to stick to the point we're trying to understand. What makes upper and lower worlds? What changes the world you're in? What do you need to do to make God part your world more? What do you need to do? Take off the garments. Take off the vessels. See that everything is the light of Hashem. That's called touching the edge of the scepter and rising up towards God. You see, what Kabbalah explains is like this. I need you to try, if you want, you could close your eyes, but I need you to try to picture in your mind, and we're going to do this very basically, but Kabbalah explains, try to picture in your mind a circle with a radius. If you could picture a circle with a radius, so Kabbalah explains that in order to create finite reality and lower worlds, picture a circle with a radius. God removed his infinite light around the circle and brought about one ray of light, which is the radius. And that ray of light is entering that circle, that void, entering that void. And as that ray of light, that kav, goes down, it makes lower worlds. It gets more vessels and garments and shells. That ray of light that's coming from God's infinity to make worlds, as it's going down, it's getting more vessels, garments, shells. And that makes the general atmospheric conditions that there are upper and lower worlds. So when you want to ascend towards God, you need to touch the edge of that scepter. You need to go up, take off the vessels and shells. Which is why when you daven, what do you need to do? You need to strip yourself from mundane reality. You close your eyes. Like the Zohar says, the reason we close our eyes when we say the Shmatz is if we leave the world. You go into a quiet corner, you go under your talus, you go out of the world. Shabbos and Yontiv is Aliyah Se'olamus. Shabbos and Yontiv, all the worlds go up that scepter. And therefore on Shabbos and Yontiv, you're actually, Shabbos and Yontiv, what's happening is that the worlds themselves, in other words, davening, let me make this more clear. Davening is you subjectively going to higher worlds. What's the premise of davening? Going up the ladder, you subjectively realizing that everything is the light of Hashem, you meditating. That's davening. That's why, by the way, how do you daven really? You know, the davening is not just saying the words. That's what Chazal say, Halavai she'ispal adam kol yom kulay. Davening is a state of mind. It's a state. Prayer is a state of being. It's not an act. Very important to know. Prayer is a state of being. It's not an act. Prayer is a constant state of being. A person that's living a prayerful life, va'ani tefillah, like King David said, is always living in a way that they're subjectively going up that shava. They're touching the head of the scepter. Esther wants to go into the king. When our soul wants to go into God, we have to go up and have a revelation of His light. We have to take off the vessels and the garments that are making me see tables and chairs and lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. I have to take off those garments, take off those shells, take off those vessels, and see that it's all the unity of God. So davening is the subjective process. Shabbos and Yontiv, objectively, the worlds go up, there's less, the garments come off. Which is the penimis of why Shabbos and Yontiv, what do you need to do with your garments? Change them. Because the garments of the worlds change in Shabbos and Yontiv. The physical objective world on Shabbos is not the same as the objective world during the week. The begodim, the garments of the world are less, are finer. That's why you have the special Shabbos dika yontiv dika garments. Because the vessels are less. And therefore we understand why you're not allowed to do labor on Shabbos and Yontiv. Because Shabbos and Yontiv, the worlds objectively are standing before, are closer to the king. You're more, the king is revealed. Let me ask you. Simple question. We all agree that God is everywhere, or we already rectified the statement and said that everywhere is God? You're always within God? Okay. Why do we stand Shemoneh Esrei like a soldier? Why do we stand like that, Shemoneh Esrei? Why are you not allowed to move, talk? Why do you stand like that, Shemoneh Esrei? What's the reason? Standing before the king. Great. So how are you ever allowed to throw yourself on a couch and eat pretzels? Why are we not always standing like in Shemoneh Esrei?
Because in Shemoneh Esrei, it's not we're standing before the king, it's our soul is standing before the king. Your soul doesn't
hurt. Are we not always standing before the king?
Yeah,
is your soul not always standing before God?
But in prayer, if we're subjectively removing the garments, we're subjectively also removing, in a way, our bodies themselves.
Correct.
And if we move, it's almost sort of like a reminder, if not actually going back into our body, to a certain.
So in other words, right. So no, it's prayer is that time that you're subjectively going before the king. And you're literally standing before the king. And the Gemara says in Chagiga, he quotes from Psachim over here, but the Gemara says that the Gemara says a story that a person stood before a king and then hinted to somebody else. When you stand before the king, you have to be completely nullified. If you're standing before the king, you're like, say, could you get me Cheerios? Could you get me the Cheerios, you know? Could you go park my car? So the Gemara says the person is Chayiv Misa. When you're standing before the king, you have to be completely, like we stand by Shemoneh Esrei. Shabbos and Yontiv, the whole world is like that. So you can't do malacha. You can't do labor. You've taken off your garments. You've taken off the vessels of the objective world, took off the vessels and garments. So you have to stand like that before God. Now, you mentioned why there are those that taka don't sleep for that reason for the whole Shabbos. There are those really righteous, unlucky few. Well, I guess they're lucky, but in my right, but there are those that the stolen or chassidim don't sleep Shabbos night. Shomer Shabbos, they say a shomer. If you're a shomer, a guard, you have to guard. You can't sleep on guard duty. Shabbos, your mom is standing before the king. So the minimum halachic thing, how do we represent the fact that Shabbos and Yontiv, the worlds are objectively taken off their garments and changed and standing before the king? You don't do malacha. You don't do labor. Because you're standing before the king. Yeah?
Just aren't those inherently different though? Because Shemoneh Esrei, it's also, it's a series of bakashot that we're asking things of God. Whereas Shabbos and Yom Tov are inherently the opposite. We're completely resting. We don't, even there's a lot of rachot, we don't say specifically because it is a bakashot.
Beautiful question. So you could even say more than that. Ask a simple, and Shabbos, so how come Yom Tov you're allowed to cook and Shabbos you can't? In other words, within this inyan of touching the head of the scepter, of ascending to God, there are many details. Shabbos is different, Pesach is different than Sukkot. Pesach you can't have chametz, Sukkot you have to eat in the Sukkah. Tefillah is bakashas. There are differences between, in other words, Yom Tov there's a mitzvah to eat. By Shemoneh Esrei you can't eat. So within this, there are going to be different halachas. But the point we're learning is that it's not haphazard, the halachas. Each one is another form of ascending the scepter and another way of going deeper into God, taking off the garments and the vessels and feeling that everything is the light of Hashem. And in that general category, there's the way that happens on Shabbos and Pesach and Sukkot and Tefillah. But generally, it's all about Miza. The Alter Rebbe quotes the pasuk from Shir Hashirim: Miza is Olam in Amidbar. Who is this arising out of the desert? We're going out of the desert, we're going closer to Hashem. And therefore, we have to be in a state of nullification. That's Yontif. Right? Going up to Hashem. Only if it's a question of just what we said until now.
Oh, I was just saying, couldn't you just explain it, the difference between ascending a mountain and standing on the top of a mountain? As long as you're ascending a mountain, you have to move. But you have to keep going up in order to get to the top. But once you're actually at the top, as long as or have been placed on the top of the mountain.
Meaning like Shabbos and Yontif is that you're placed on top of the mountain.
And exactly. Okay. The only way to go up is to look. You can't move.
In other words, you're saying that tefillah is subjective. Shabbos and Yontif is objective. Okay, I hear that's true. But don't forget that even in Shabbos and Yontif, people don't have the same Shabbos.
Yeah.
Right? Every Shabbos is also different. There's a Shabbos Dika Shabbos and there's a Vacha Dika Shabbos, right? Like the Pizza, you know, the Shabbos you have is based on the week that you prepare for, right? Anyway, but that's to answer your question. When you learn deeper, all the details of halacha are all reflect the Kabbalistic truth of what exactly, how are you going further up in Hashem? Okay, now we go a step deeper in case that wasn't deep enough. You ready? The truth of God is that God is not light, energy, vessels, or revelation. God is the all. And when you come to a deeper state of coming to the essence of what God really is, you realize that whether it's revealed light of God, upper worlds, angels, or it's vessels and garments and even shells, all of existence is God. Vis-a-vis Hashem, the way the Alter Rebbe says it was, ki'ilu ein olam is klal. Vis-a-vis the essence of what God is, in truth, from God's perspective, forget worlds. Worlds are our perspectives. Let's talk about from God's perspective. When God is looking, when God is looking at all of the myriads of details of reality, what does God see? Just himself. And does God see a difference in how he is in light or in vessels and garments? When God is looking from God's perspective, when he sees this chair, or he sees the Aron, the Ark, and the Holy of Holies, when God is looking, he just sees it's all him equally. And therefore, when God gives you the whole scepter, which is himself, you don't need to get up anymore. You don't need to ascend anywhere, because everything is he. When God reveals the essence of what he is, then any way you are is already unified within him. Once you understand that God is existence, and when God, from God's perspective, there's no worlds, from God's perspective, there is no myriad of perspectives. From God's perspective, he sees that he's the all, that everything is equally he, him, whatever. Right? So Purim was such a revelation of Hashem's essence that there didn't have to be supernatural miracles. Purim, the minhag is to get dressed up. Not like in Shabbos and Yontif, where you put on special Shabbos Dika Yontif garments, you take off your weekday garments. And you go to higher garments, you wear holy clothing. Purim, what do you dress as? The opposite. You conceal yourself even more. Purim, Hashem didn't take off the garments of the world. Purim was the revelation that Shushan Habira, as is, when we're still servants to Achashverosh. Purim, there was no redemption from Achashverosh. Remember the Gemara Megillah says, one of the reasons we don't say Halal on Purim. Why don't we say Halal on Purim? Because Akati Avdad Achashverosh Anan, the Gemara says, one of the reasons, because we were still servants of Achashverosh. It's not like in Egypt where God took off the garments of Egypt. Pesach, Hashem destroyed the Egyptians. He destroyed those shells. He took us out of Egypt. Purim, he didn't take us out of Shushan. We still were in Shushan. But what was revealed? That Shushan as is, Ahasuerus's romance, and all these romantic escapades between Esther and Haman and all these things, God is in all of them equally. And therefore, there's nothing to ascend. You don't change reality. The fact that it's in nature, that Purim, the miracle, is in nature, shows you that it's coming from the essence of Hashem. It's not ascending up a ray of light. It's the truth of the essence of God, which is everything equally. And therefore, you don't even have to stand before the king. You could do malacha. You could do whatever you want. And it's still Hashem. You don't have to do anything special. You could party and jump and dance and do everything we do in Purim. And it's still one with God. And you understand that that's the truth of Mashiach. You see, some people think, a lot of, you know, there are some people that if you ask them honestly, that if they're really inside, they don't want Mashiach to come. To be honest, there are a lot of people that don't really, if you're really inside, they don't want Mashiach to come because they're scared. They think it's going to be like some kind of Armageddon. And I don't mean the one with Bruce Willis where everyone else lives except Bruce. They think there's going to be some kind of like California's going to drop off the map. And like people have this, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And like people have this like vision that the whole world's going to be destroyed. And we're all going to move into the old city in Jerusalem and live in some cramped apartment in the old city. Right? And we're all going to have like some real estate if you're going to have 1,000 people in one apartment, we're all going to be cramped in. We're all going to stand for the rest of time in the Holy Temple watching blood of animals being splattered on the altar. And that's going to be our life for the rest of our old time. If that was Mashiach, I also wouldn't want Mashiach to come. But you understand that that's not redemption of reality. That's destruction of reality. That's not Mashiach. The Rambam says, and the Rambam speaks like a Hungarian, because he wants to make sure you get it. Al yal adas. Don't think redemption means cessation of the world that you know. No. Redemption is the world as you know it will be exactly like it is now. You'll be living in the same house and everything will be the same. There's one difference though. You'll see that it's all God. The redemption of reality. Nafla loy soysif kum. She has fallen and she will no longer rise up, the maiden of Israel. When Mashiach comes, we're not going to need to rise up. Because there will be revealed God's infinite essence, b'tachtonim, in the lowest world as we know it. You'll be allowed to do malacha. You're going to do the same things. The only difference is that, you know, there's going to be everything John Lennon says, except no religion, will also be. There'll be no war and there's not going to be competition. Those things are true. The good parts are going to be there. The bad parts won't. But the reality is going to be the same. And it'll be revealed, the secret of Purim, Beis Haman Achashverosh gives to Esther. Do you understand? Beis Haman, by Egypt. Egypt was destroyed. The end of the Megillah is that Haman's house, Mordechai is living in. Mashiach is that the world, Beis Haman, the world as you know, with the Malacha, God's infinite essence will be revealed in the garments, and not just garments, in the shells. When you dress up, whatever you're dressing up as on Purim, Scooby-Doo, whatever you happen to choose, right? It'll be revealed as also Hashem. And therefore, you understand, listen carefully, when it comes to Shabbos and Yontiv. So Shabbos and Yontiv, since we're rising up, and it's based, and it's an objective thing of a rising up of how much a revelation you're having. So how much joy can you have in Shabbos and Yontiv? Based on how much of revelation you're experiencing. Right? How much, like we said before, how much you prepare yourself for Shabbos. How much you prepare yourself for Yontiv. How much you meditate, what a Sukkot is, what a Pesach is. So the wine, the Simcha, is going to be relative. Purim, how much of God is being revealed to you? All of it. How could you contain that? You can't. And therefore, what's the way to, quote unquote, receive that revelation. Adeloyada. There can't be finite perception. Purim is not about your finite perception. Purim is not about a finite perception. Purim is the revelation of God's infinite essence as you are. You can't contain that with your mind. Or to paraphrase Rabbi Yaakov Nicholson, you can't handle that truth. So what do you need to do to be able to partake of that Purim? What do you need to do? You need to get rid of Das. You need to get rid of Das. Adeloyada. You need to get rid of your finite perspective. You need to go out of your mind, your perspective, just to partake of that. And then Rav Zevin says a step deeper. And then with this, we're gonna the last thing. Based on this, we could also understand what brought about that Purim Dikkur revelation, and therefore we could also understand what's going to bring about that Messianic revelation. Now that we know what the revelation of Purim and Mashiach is, now we need to say, well, what brought that about on Purim? And what does that mean for us now? How do we bring that about now in our lives that Mashiach should come? So what differentiated Purim from any other Yontif? In other words, we said that Purim is the holiday where there was no miracle. It's God's essence, which therefore, there was no miracle. It was in the world as is, within Shushan. As were slaves to Achashverosh, the natural world remained. It was revealed within the vessels of the world, within the garments of the world. Kalim, Ekalim, Shoinim. As the world is, it's all Hashem. That was the revelation of Purim. And that's what Mashiach is. Now, how did we are the ones that brought about that revelation of Purim. What did we do on Purim that was different than what we did to bring about, that brought about any other Yom Tov? So what the Alter Rebbe says is like this. Purim was the one time where the Jewish people lived for an entire year with the threat of annihilation, right? And yet, they didn't want to convert. The Alter Rebbe learns, and I know there are those that disagree, but the Alter Rebbe says that the Gzeirah of Haman and Achashverosh was only in those that were Jews, but those that would have, as opposed to Hitler, as those that would have converted would not have been killed. Now, you know, remember, what was the Purim story? Achashverosh sends out those middle letters, and he says that everyone is allowed to kill all the Jews. When was that? When did he send out the letters? Anyone know? What day? When was it? Nisan. Nisan, right? The whole, by the way, you should just know, I don't have time to get into it, but chronologically, the whole Purim story happened in Nisan. Those were the 3 days that they fasted. They didn't have a Seder that year. That's the Gemara says.
That happened over 12 years.
I'm talking about from when Esther goes in. Haman throws the Geirel in Nisan. They then get the whole thing. That all happens in Nisan. The 3 days of fasting is in Nisan. Pesach is when she goes into the king. Haman's Yahrzeit is the second day Pesach. That's when Haman's Yahrzeit is. That's when he was actually hanged, right? So Nisan is when that story actually happens. When was the... So Haman threw the girl the lottery to kill all the Jews when? What day was it that was supposed to kill all the Jews? When was the ultimate Auschwitz of all 127? When were all Jews supposed to be annihilated? Huh? What day of the year?
The next year on Adar.
What day of Adar?
The
14th. No, the 14th is when we rested.
No,
the 13th. Nachum Eiveihem. Tonight, the 13th of Adar. Haman's girl fell on the 13th of Adar, which is tonight. So that's exactly a year. And Jews lived an entire year with the threat of annihilation. And yet they didn't, they were Moser Nefesh. They didn't, they did it, they were willing to, they wouldn't give up there on the Yiddishkeit. So as opposed to the Alter Rebbe says, let's say on Shavuos. Shavuos also our souls went up to Hashem. But that was a moment of inspiration. That was a peak experience. You see, all the other Shabbos and Yontivs are peak experiences. Peak experiences are nice, moments of inspiration, but they're flashes, they come and go. Purim was the only time in our history that Jews lived an entire year, and a year is a long time. And a year means whatever we were doing for that entire year in the course of our life. And each aspect, the entire year, whatever we were doing, we wanted God and nothing else. We weren't willing to give over our Yiddishkeit. So living in such a way where for an entire year we lived a mundane life. This wasn't moments of inspiration. This wasn't seminars or retreats or peak experiences. This was vachadikateg, an entire year. And living an entire year with this feeling that no matter what I'm doing the entire year, my life is Hashem and I'm willing to die for that. That brought about that revelation of Hashem in the physical world as is. And therefore, what does that mean vis-a-vis us with Mashiach? The same thing. What do we need to do, Hasidic philosophy says, to bring Mashiach? What do you need to really do? Live our lives in such a way that no matter what we're doing, God is our world. Not just when we're standing before God by prayer. Not just on Shabbos and Yontiv. When you're sitting on your couch with the pretzels. When you're in your cubicle at work. When you're sitting in traffic. If we live all the time with all the shinuyim of Shana, with all the differentiations, just like at the time of the Megillah, living in such a way, that's what the Baal Shem Tov wanted. That's why the Baal Shem Tov, people make a mistake. The Baal Shem Tov didn't say that even simple Jews could connect to God. That's not what the Baal Shem Tov said. The Baal Shem Tov said for Mashiach to come, all Jews have to feel equally that they're connected to God all the time. Because that is what Mashiach is, you understand? Mashiach is that redemption of reality, showing that all the details of the world and life are God. And if the Baal Shem Tov didn't give like a runners-up prize, oh yeah, even if you don't know how to learn Gemara, you could be one with Hashem. No! The Baal Shem Tov revealed that the truth of Mashiach necessitates that we all live in such a way that God should be our world no matter what we're doing. Mashiach will not be miraculous, at least in the beginning. It's to show the life that we know is one with Hashem. And that's the ultimate Adlo Yoda. Das is all about differentiating. And Das is all about meditating, having in mind, approaching. That's Das. You need Das to daven. You need Das to differentiate. Ein Das Avdol Minayin. You need Das to be able to subjectively approach God. But Adlo Yoda means it's not about Das. It's just being one with Hashem all the time. That's Purim. And when we live a Purimdika life the whole year, that'll mitzvah Hashem be Mashiach. A Freilich and Purim, everyone should be, we should be Zoicha to Takev Adelo Yoda, and it should be an eternal Adelo Yoda, Mitzvah Hashem. We should dance and sing with Mashiach.